There's another security vulnerability in LastPass. Facebook is just copying everyone. Just get used to it. They're going to look exactly like Snapchat. And Ian Thompson is here to talk about ISP broadband privacy and the vote that happened today in the House of Representatives. All that and so much more coming right up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1734, recorded Tuesday, March 28th, 2017.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the only show where we tell you what you need to know about technology. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Nathan Olivatis-Giles. And today's guest is Ian Thompson from The Register to talk about Congress passing what the Senate introduced last week, which is basically giving ISPs free rein to collect data and sell to marketers. It's going to be a great conversation. Stick for that. But before that, we're going to get into some news here. Facebook is rolling out an update today that will make it look a lot like Snapchat and a lot like Instagram and a lot like WhatsApp. The world's most popular social networking app now has what it calls stories, which are photos and videos that disappear after 24 hours and can be seen by all of your Facebook friends or sent to a specific buddy or group of buddies as well. Like all those other apps, they are interactive and have little filters and emojis, and you can add text and some little finger drawings to what you're going to share out there. And Facebook now has been testing this for months, but this feature looks and works pretty much exactly the same as it does on other apps Facebook owns, including Instagram and WhatsApp. So if you're using those other apps, this is going to, you know, be very familiar to you. But make no mistake about it here, this feature brings the sameness to these three apps on Facebook's part, in large part to fight off Snapchat, which kicked off the whole ephemeral messaging craze and recently went public and is seen as a major threat to Facebook's social media audience and ad sales dominance. So I got to ask you, Megan, do you think Snapchat should be worried here? They kind of kicked things off in 2013. It's taken a while for Facebook to mimic or rip off or however you want to describe it. But what do you think here? Should Snapchat be worried?
I think they should be worried because I think that most people that use Facebook and Instagram are adults. And I think that many people who use Snapchat are not adults. So I think there's not necessarily buy-in for them yet. But I mean, they will be adults. So I don't know. Time will tell whether they will just continue to say Facebook is not for me. It's for old people. Instagram is not for me either. So I don't know. That is, I think we just have to wait and see. I mean, Snapchat is also not international as Facebook is. So I think they should be worried, but I also, I don't know how people are going to take these new features. They seem really cluttered, and I don't know if people will like them.
Yeah, I do wonder if the main Facebook app is just getting so bloated. And in fact, Facebook Messenger has a feature that's very similar, where you can upload these photos and videos that will disappear after 24 hours. Your friends in Facebook Messenger, which are your same friends in the main Facebook app, can see that inside of Messenger. But the tricky thing is this version of stories in Messenger and the version of stories in the main Facebook app aren't the same. So if you upload one in one place, you're not going to see it in the other, which just seems really confusing that there's not a connection here, that these things are siloed off. So that just doesn't seem well thought out to me. But I like what you brought up in the audience question here. You know, this might keep, you know, if some of those adults who are stuck on Facebook now give Snapchat a chance, I wonder if they're going to be like, oh, this is just like what I see on Facebook. And then when those teens go into Facebook, I wonder if they're going to be like, oh, this is just like Snapchat, if it might keep those groups separated or not.
I don't know. I think that Snapchat can be confusing to even technically inclined adults like myself. Like, I can figure Snapchat out. It's just not worth it to me. Like, mm-hmm. I don't like it. So I like the filters and I use them and then I post them elsewhere. And so, I don't know. I think what we should do is come up with our own social media app and we should just call it Copy Chat. And it's everything else, just all the things taken from everything else. And we'll just call it Copy Chat. And it's like, we're not lying. Like, we're just copying everyone else. That's what we do.
That would be shameless. And that would be kind of like what we see major tech companies doing right now. But as much as this is about Facebook fighting off Snapchat, an up-and-comer, a challenger, there's other things here that we have to pay attention to. We have to acknowledge that are at the core of this. Let's talk a little bit about that. Facebook has 1.65 billion people using its main app every day, which is maybe why they would want to bring this feature there, to get those folks to use it, to gain some traction. And obviously, they make their money off of advertising. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, Nilay Patel had a really interesting piece in The Verge today about this is about money. This is not about human behavior, because that's what a lot of people are saying. They're like, oh, well, Facebook is just giving us what we want, or Snapchat just is giving us what we want. But really, they're just trying to sell ads to us. And that is really true. And I find that fascinating, because when he said a lot of people are saying the camera is the new keyboard and we're communicating with the camera. And I get that. Like, you know, I have kids and that's what they tell me too. Like, I like to express myself with the camera and Snapchat. It's easier than texting because I can show more emotion and, you know, I can actually, people can see what I'm saying and not get misunderstood. And I was, you know, I just say, well, you know, we had that back in my day. It was called talking to people, you know, face to face. And so, you know, it's like, that's what Snapchat and a lot of these technology companies are trying to convince us, that they're just creating exactly what we wanted all along, when that's not necessarily true. They're creating the thing that they can advertise to us for as long as possible. Yeah. And I think that, you know, they have psychologists working on this. They have human behaviorists. They have all kinds of people who are trying to figure out, how long can I get human beings to use my service? How many daily active users can I get? How many people can I get coming back every day? They don't care if it's not healthy for you, because it means money for them.
Yeah, these are really interesting points. In some reporting that I've done in the past and speaking with folks at WhatsApp, at Instagram, the argument, you know, when I've always asked, you know, so this is just basically ripping off Snapchat, right? And this is all about that. The argument I've gotten from folks at those apps inside of Facebook is that this is a new format, a new way of communicating, and this is something people want. And essentially, as though, you know, writing is a form of human communication. Conversation and vocal speech is a form of human communication. Emotions and these sorts of things. But a little video clip, you know, with a filter that ties to the latest movie that's coming out this weekend that disappears after 24 hours. Is that truly the latest form of humanity reaching out to one another? That seems like quite a stretch. But that is the argument that these companies are genuinely making. And it doesn't, you know, it might sound a bit overhyped on our part, but that's the stuff that we're getting from them. So I'm glad you brought that up. You know, video ads, Mark Zuckerberg said for a while that video is going to be the future of Facebook, that and advertising goes hand in hand with that. They're even starting to put ads in videos that are being uploaded, like in the middle of a video and things like this. How far away do you think we are from seeing Facebook that's just dominated by this sort of stuff, whether it's live video, whether it's ephemeral video? I mean, is this where it's all going?
Well, I think that's what Facebook would have us believe, that it's all going, because we know we've seen statistics that just regular sharing, regular personal sharing, is going down. People aren't as likely to, you know, pour their hearts out on Facebook as often. And, you know, we're getting the idea like, oh, maybe it's not a great idea to post pictures of my children. Maybe it's not a great idea to tell the world that I'm going on vacation when I'm going on vacation. And so I think that personal sharing is going down. They have to figure out a way to keep us there. Well, a day does not go by when we do not recommend the password manager LastPass. We all use the corporate version here at work, and I could not recommend it more highly. But for the second time in only 2 weeks, we're hearing that a second vulnerability in LastPass could allow for remote code execution or password theft. Tavis Ormandy from Google tweeted about the exploit a few days ago, which he said he worked out in his head while taking a shower. Let's hear it for shower thoughts. That is not what I think about in the shower, but apparently it's what Tavis Ormandy does. So last week, LastPass fixed a critical zero day, also discovered by Ormandy. This affects the LastPass browser extension, and LastPass has already offered a security update. So I think that must be an automatic update. I don't think you have to go in and update. What do you think about LastPass?
Just as you said, I've recommended it to friends and family and coworkers for years. And I don't know a tech journalist out there who doesn't recommend using a password manager. I do wonder, though, if this little dip here for LastPass will help out some competitors. There are other options out there. LastPass is great and easy to use. I'm glad that they're being transparent about this and they're saying, hey, listen, we saw the reports, we're looking into it, and it really seems like they're handling this about as good as they can.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they say thank you to Ormandy. This is how, thank you for the help, as opposed to, other sources that might say, like, don't talk about it because otherwise you give people ideas. But of course, he didn't talk about it until they had already fixed it, which is, the way to go about this. So, yeah, I think I'm always nervous. I live in a state of anxiety, and it's I actually keep my I have only two passwords that I remember. My iCloud password and my LastPass password, because I just feel like I don't want to keep my iCloud password in my LastPass. I just want to keep it in here where no one can get at it.
At least until Elon Musk's brain nodes start coming out in 2077 exactly. Or whatever it is. So. Well, Tinder wants you to give a swipe on your laptop. The popular dating app launched a desktop web version of its mobile app called Tinder Online, which just kind of cracks me up because the mobile version is connected to the internet and online too. But let's not get into that. The company told TechCrunch that the web version was built for singles in emerging markets who don't have enough storage on their phone for the app or a big enough data plan for Tinder. Now, remember, Tinder relies on you swiping through photos. Either you swipe right to approve a potential match or you swipe left to dismiss someone. The website only handles a virtual swiping because not every laptop has a touchscreen, as I know with my Mac here. And you can also do messaging on the website. But so far, none of the paid features like Tinder Boost or Super Like are available. This seems like a somewhat old school idea, like building a website. But I got to say, I'm really glad they're doing this. I'm not a Tinder user and not a big fan of it when I've used it in the past. But it just makes sense that they would have this option for folks as well. And I kind of wonder what took them so long.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think because swiping is integral to it. And now you have to click and drag, which doesn't. Click and drag on that.
It's not as easy. It's definitely not as easy and as fast to click and drag. Not as fun to say, or maybe it's more fun to say.
Well, I think that's also what they were getting at, because I think they don't like the reputation of being the hookup app. They keep saying like, look,
being real about it.
Did you just click and drag me away, Brian? Wasn't very nice. Oh, there it
is. I clicked and dragged to you.
Okay, all right.
I don't know if that's more flattering or not.
I don't know
if there's a good way to do that.
I don't know how I feel about it either way. But I think that they constantly play up like, look at these people that got married. They met on Tinder. Like they don't want to be the hookup app. And so what they were saying also in this press release is that this allows for more conversation. There's half of the screen is for conversation. I'm not saying face-to-face conversation, but, typing.
Yeah, messaging.
Messaging. Yeah. And, so it's less swiping, more conversing. That's how you can get along with people, because I think they've probably heard the same statistics that what this constant swiping does to people, not just the hookups, but just that if you have all these possibilities, you feel like you can swipe forever, then no one's ever going to seem good enough to you. So I'm sure they again have understood that they might have to have a little bit of a different image. So maybe they think on the PC you're slowing down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be a terrible thing to slow down a little bit with Tinder. To be clear, I actually do have two friends who met their wives in using Tinder. For some, it is more than a hookup. But one of the things I think is really interesting here is Tinder's owned by IAC's Match Group, which also owns the websites Match.com, OkCupid, BlackPeopleMeet.com, Chemistry.com, and Plenty of Fish, and lots of other dating websites. So in some sense, it seems like you have all this long history and know-how on the web, and they really understand how dating for a desktop web environment works. And I'm kind of wondering if some features and some of that know-how from these other parts of the company will come over into Tinder. They do kind of seem to have been doing their own thing for a while. So that'll be interesting to see.
The Guardian reports that the FBI's facial recognition database contains nearly 412 million photos, but it is wrong 15% of the time. The software that the FBI uses is more likely to misidentify black people and women, which means it's especially wrong about identifying black women. The database acquires photos from mugshots, but also from IDs of people who have never committed a crime and from several other sources. Now, this means that the FBI's policies are in direct violation of the Privacy Act of 1974, which places limitations on agencies' collection, disclosure, and use of personal information maintained in their systems of records. Plus, according to a full House Oversight Committee on Facial Recognition Reform, the FBI used this kind of facial recognition for years without examining its impact on privacy. They did not even have a privacy statement in place. So you actually brought this story to my attention. What do you think is important about this story?
Well, there's so much here that I think is important. I mean, for one thing, I think it's just important that all of our viewers, you know, whether you live in the United States or not, know what your government agencies are collecting on you, right? I mean, the FBI is, you know, for Americans is here to protect us, right? And keep us safe. But we do need transparency and need to know what sort of stuff is being collected on us and how. And in part to know what our rights are, but in part to know if things are being done wrong, because that can happen as well. And I just think that there's this interesting cultural trend that we see again and again with algorithms, with technology, with facial recognition, with image recognition that's built this way, that particularly misidentifies people of color, whether it's situations like this where it actually mistakes them for someone else, or situations where in Google and in Facebook, people of color were being seen as misidentified as animals and all sorts of things like that. Now, there are obviously big questions here. How dumb is this technology and how not good is it? Obviously, things need to improve, and the only way to improve it is to feed it more data in some instances. But I think there you have to also ask the questions of who's building these things, and do they include some of these communities that are being affected and possibly negatively impacted? Now, it's one thing for a Google search result to be wrong, but it's a whole other thing for the FBI to be misidentifying someone, and that could lead to some serious consequences in someone's life if it's related to an investigation of a crime. So everything about this fascinates me, but I think it's, you know, just important stuff that, you know, that we all need to know about.
Yeah, I mean, half of all Americans 18 and over are in this database, and they said, you know, they said that it's 15% of the time wrong. And I mean, we've seen facial recognition technology. We know how it works in Facebook and in Google. And yes, it makes some big mistakes, but it is often right. And I feel like what you said, like this tech, they're using kind of some cruddy technology. Like they should get better. I mean, Baidu, they said that their facial recognition technology is 99.77% of the time correct. So yeah, it's and what this article in the Guardian said was that the FBI is probably working with a lot of lower image quality, so not photos that people are uploading like they would to Facebook, but you know, some sort of surveillance technology or something like that. So that's harder. But yeah, I am glad that people are looking at this and taking this into account, because I do think that facial recognition is one of those slightly terrifying things that we don't like to think about. I recently looked into all the data that that Facebook has about me and downloaded it. And one of the things is it's your face print, the number, and it shows how many, you know, how many samples they have. And it's just this bizarre number that is my face. And that's really scary to think about.
It is scary to think about, but it's something that at the same time we have to own and recognize it's here. You know, it's here. And whether it's Facebook or it's the FBI or anything, this technology exists, and you know, hopefully it will be improved and serve some kind of social good. But you know, these are important public. This is an important public dialogue to have, and we can't be left out of this conversation.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, computers aren't racist, but we're feeding it all this information and giving it all these statistics, and then people are using it. So we have to recognize that the people using it, we might have biases.
Definitely. For one app maker, the 12th time was a charm today, but only for a few hours. After an app that tracks U.S.-executed drone strikes was rejected by Apple a dozen times, the iPhone maker approved the app called Metadata Plus for the iOS App Store today. But the approval did not last long. The app was pulled down about 5 hours later. The app's creator, Josh Begley, posted on Twitter about his app being pulled, showing the App Store notification. And he wrote in a piece for The Intercept, where he works as a research editor, that Apple said the app was booted for what is called excessively objectionable or crude content. Pretty interesting story here. I wonder if he's going to try a 13th time. But what do you think about this? I mean, this is an app that literally would map out U.S. executed drone strikes on a map. You'd see a country, you'd see like a little pin, and you'd see information. Now, to be clear, a lot of this information was shared publicly by the government. He was just mapping out the data. But do you think this is crude stuff? Is Apple in the right here?
Well, I don't think it was just shared publicly. It was the news. It was news reports of drone strikes. So that's what it is. So basically, this is a news aggregation app. Like, notify me if there is news about drone strikes. Like, there's apps like notify me if there's news about iPhones. You know, like,
yeah.
It's different. And I couldn't wrap my head around this. I just thought, they say it's crude. Is it crude because, you know, a drone strike might relate in, you know, result in a death? And so it's like, you know, getting notified when someone dies. But I checked the App Store. There are several apps that you can download right now from the App Store that will notify you when a celebrity dies. So, you know, it's not that. I put it out on Twitter because I have a lot of people that follow me on Twitter who are very wise, much wiser about these things than I do. Eric Peterman suggested that it's because Apple forbids certain political statements per the developer terms and conditions. So I get that this is a political statement. Every time we make a drone strike, then that's why they're saying that it's outside of the developer.
Yeah, it is interesting that this could be seen as a political statement. And just looking at the screenshots for the app, I wasn't able to download it myself because I found out about it after it was pulled. But more than 50,000 people did actually download it during its five-hour window that it was up. So it seems as though there is an audience and an appetite for this sort of information. But from what I've seen in the screenshots, it didn't seem overly political or criticizing what happened. It really seemed like it was mapping out data that was already out there in the world anyways. That being said, in Begley, in his piece for The Intercept, did end it by noting that he believes and raised the question that maybe what's truly crude and distasteful here is the drone strikes themselves. So clearly he does have a political stance and a viewpoint on this. But, you know, a lot of news publications do share opinion from time to time. And I gotta wonder if it was the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or even The Intercept itself, where Begley works, putting out this app, if they would pull it or not.
It is available. Ed on Twitter tells me it's available in the Google Play Store.
Good to know.
Get it. This is an interesting one. It wasn't. Someone said, "Well, I guess maybe Trump pulled it," and that's not true. He's been trying to get it for years. So Obama, under the Obama administration of the Apple App Store process,
yeah.
It was also not allowed. But have a political statement, because you know that app that you could get a few weeks ago. Maybe they pulled this too, where like it was Trump with the thing, and you could write anything. You could have anything written on the little signing paper that he has. Like that's political.
Yeah, Snapchat had filters for both Trump supporters and Hillary Clinton supporters during the election.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's political stuff all over the place.
Right. So, I mean, this is just conjecture on our part. Obviously, the Apple App Store is allowed to do whatever they want. They're not, you know, they're not beholden to, and it's not like our right of free speech to get something in the App Store.
Yeah, it's a publicly held company, but nonetheless, it's not a free speech place. It is a business, right?
Right. But I mean, I also think that it's so big and has such an influence on us that it behooves us to discuss why they're making certain decisions.
Yeah, and you got to wonder what sort of responsibilities Apple has and to who. Do they have a responsibility to us as users to get the most accurate information, the information that's interesting to us? I mean, some people genuinely care about drone strikes and how many the U.S. is committing and whether they were justified or not, and all sorts of things like that. And obviously some don't care for this sort of information being out there. But I'm glad that you brought up that he has been trying, and it's not necessarily something that's tied to like the Trump administration or anything like that. Apple actually approved this app in 2014 for about a year, and then it was pulled, and that was after it was rejected 5 times. So he's been going through this quite a while. So if I had to guess, I would guess there would be a 13th try, but we'll see.
Yeah, the app is called Metadata by Josh Bagley if you want to search the App Store. Today, the U.S. House of Representatives officially voted to overturn broadband privacy rules that the FCC approved late last year. The vote was 215 to 205 for rules that would have protected our ISP when our protected us when our ISP wanted to sell all of our data. Joining us to talk about what we can do now is Ian Thompson from The Register. Welcome back to the show, Ian.
Always a pleasure, Megan.
I know, even with bad news, it's still good to see you.
Yeah, I know. We've been livid about this all day in the office. It's an utterly stupid law, which benefits no one apart from the telcos. Now, you can understand sort of exchanging a certain amount of private information to be sold adverts for something like Facebook or even Gmail, because, you know, you're only showing them a limited subset of what you're doing online, and in return, you're getting a service like Facebook, or you're getting free webmail or whatever. But what this does is take the entire thing, hand it straight over to the telcos so they can sell it for fun and profit. We're going to see those super cookies coming back on the phones that you can't possibly delete. You may see search engine redirection as well. It's basically a grab bag of everything the telecoms industry has wanted, and it serves no useful purpose other than to pad their bottom line.
So the privacy rules that never went into effect, the ones that were passed at the very end of the Obama administration, so is anything going to change for us now?
The privacy rules that went in that went in there didn't actually come into effect, but they were sort of the telcos were preparing for them. But there were strict rules about what could and couldn't be sold on to advertisers. This basically blasts the whole thing away. The only people now who can actually bring in rules, as I understand it, is the FTC, and they have no interest in doing so. So it's open season on your browsing history and what you get up to online. There really is, it does appear at this stage as though basically ISPs have been given complete free rein and told go at it.
So they can collect anything. I mean, what are some examples of those things that they can collect?
Every domain that you visit online, how long you stay on there, how far you drill down into the site. It's going to be a little bit trickier with HTTPS sites, but even then there's ways to hack around that. The super cookies on your mobile, which you can't delete and which track everything you do on your mobile, those two look like they're now legal and are likely to be introduced. Verizon's a big fan of those. Basically, absolutely everything that goes through your internet pipe can now be stored and sold on to whoever's got the money and the telcos feel like dealing with. Now, from the discussions I've had with, I had a chat with the CEO of Sonic yesterday about this, the California ISP. And he's saying it's unlikely that what they'll do is sell an individual's browser history to an advertiser, partly because it would be commercial side, but also because that's a level of depth that most advertising agencies don't want. What they will want is say, right, we want people within the 18 to 45 age group who spend at least 4 hours online, who have been looking at cars or car websites in the last week. And then they'll be able to push advertising out to that. And in fact, the ISP can inject their own adverts into what you're watching. And in some cases, as we've seen in the past, if you do a search for something, they will redirect you to a third-party website who has paid them to redirect them to you and work through their search engine rather than one you actually picked, which is a wee bit peeving. Let's just say that.
Ian, I wonder if you might have some insight as to the differences in the sort of things that are going to be actively placed on our devices, like super cookies, and between maybe, say, like Android, which seems to be kind of the wild, wild west of customization from hardware makers and telecommunications companies, versus, say, Apple and the iPhone and iOS devices, which is a lot more controlled and seems to be less friendly to outside companies installing their software on the device. I mean, now what an ISP collects as you're doing that surfing, that's a different issue. But this sort of software and advertisements and cookies that will track you and are being installed on your devices without you knowing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the case of super cookies, then they are part of the network infrastructure of your cellular provider. So even if Apple don't particularly like them, then they're going to have to accept them being on there. What I think you are going to see is device manufacturers getting a lot more picky about what software they allow on their phones in particular, because I think they're aware that if this gets too out of hand, then it's going to hurt them as much as it hurts the ISP, or should hurt the ISPs. ISPs, I think it depends very much on territories they're going to put this in. Over half of Americans don't have a choice as to where they get their internet, their high-speed internet, 25 megabits or above. They'll only have one provider who can provide that within their region, which is almost cartel-like, but that would be a terrible thing to assert on a broadcast interview like this. But in terms of sort of individual device manufacturers, you know, when you sell a device that's connected to, say, a cellular network, the cellular provider usually insists on having some software on there, and that's where this is going to sneak in.
So you mentioned Dane Jasper, the CEO of Sonic. And that's a local company. Dane's been on the Twit Network a few times. And I just signed up for Sonic. I had Comcast, and people warned me, like, maybe the speed isn't so great. But I said, this is something that I trust. I want to try it. So does that mean that, does he say that he'll never do this? Or did he say that, you know, he just doesn't? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, will it be economically unfeasible at some point for him not to sell my data?
Well, this is the big worry. I was speaking to Bruce Schneier about this yesterday, and he basically said that American corporations, it's always a race to the bottom. And if you've got a revenue stream and you're not actually using it, then shareholders at some point are going to demand that you do. I mean, I'm a Sonic customer as well, and Dane was very clear that this is not something that he wants to get involved in. He's written an open letter to Congress about it. He's written articles decrying this. He's lobbied hard against it. I think, to be honest, there will be holdouts who won't take part in this, and it will be the smaller ISPs, because that gives them a very useful selling point. You know, at the moment, AT&T will stop using your data. You know, you can get off the AT&T data collection route if you pay an extra $30 a month. Now, if an ISP can say, we're not going to touch your data, we're not going to charge you not to touch your data, that's a significant selling point. And I think, to be honest, those smaller ISPs that don't do that are going to see a real competitive boost, because once people realize what's going on, and if these ads get very intrusive, then it's going to be a very good reason to switch ISPs if you can. The problem is, for the vast amount of the country, you just genuinely can't. You're very limited in terms of what ISP you can get, because the market has been rigged to be so anti-competitive.
Do you think we could see a sort of situation where there could be different tiers, like an extra private tier from a major corporation that is amassing this data? Because clearly there's going to be pressure from shareholders and things like that to build this business. And this is a business that already exists, and obviously one that these companies want to grow, albeit at their customers' expense. Do you hear any rumblings of the sort of situation where we might have to pay a company to not share our data?
I think that's very likely indeed. I mentioned the AT&T example. I can see, as this comes through, the larger ISPs will say, well, okay, there's obviously a demand out there for people not to have their data mined by advertisers. So we'll give you that opportunity, but you will have to pay for it. And based on the examples we've got at the moment, you'll have to pay really quite significantly for it. So this is where I think the smaller ISPs who may not charge for that could gain a significant advantage. But if you're stuck with the one ISP, yeah, I think a little way down the line, they may well do this. It's an extra revenue stream for them after all. I think what will happen is they'll see how much revenue they can generate from this, and then price out those plans accordingly, and then say that they're reacting to customer demand.
More of like privacy being a privilege only allotted to a few.
Oh, yes. Yes, privacy is a privilege that you pay for. And if you can't pay, then open season on everything you do online. And bear in mind also that, you know, it's all about who they're selling this data to. And they don't have to tell you who they're selling the data to. They don't have to tell you how much they're charging for it. So you can't get an idea of what a reasonable cost would be. Basically, the House and Senate have handed them a massive revenue generating opportunity, which has no real benefit for us unless you count getting highly targeted adverts as some kind of a benefit rather than an annoyance.
So you say one solution is for people to use Tor, but that comes with its a whole host of problems. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, certainly. I mean, a lot of websites, particularly those that rely on selling adverts to people on their sites, aren't particularly fond of Tor for obvious reasons. So they may doubt. We've had a study last year which showed a lot of these sites are actually downgrading Tor users in terms of performance. We've also got CDN networks like Cloudflare who have a horrible relationship with Tor. They don't like it at all. And there have been various sort of Tor users have been either been kicked off or forced to do endless captures in order to prove they're not a robot. And bear in mind also with Tor, you've got to make sure that you are patched at all times because there are frequent patches going out there because everyone's trying to crack it. And so there's a considerable amount of upkeep involved. And also, to be quite frank, I mean, the test I use for this is, could I get my mother to use it? And if I went in and set it up for her and explained to her exactly how to do it, I'm pretty sure she could use it, but I'd be getting tech support calls every 2 to 3 weeks. So whether or not this is useful to the average person on the street, I'm iffy about. I mean, if you're listening to Twit, then you're obviously tech savvy, so you know what's going on, and it's not that hard to set up if you're using Mac OS or Windows. If you're using Chrome OS, then Tor is a real bugger to set up because you've got to sort of futz about with the operating system and download all these different things and run things through proxies. And it's, yeah, for Chromebook users, it's going to be a real pain in the backside.
So full disclosure, Cloudflare, who you mentioned, is a sponsor, and Sonic, who I mentioned, is also a sponsor. Do you have a question, Nate?
Yeah, I got a couple more. Ian, I wonder, how will this impact MVNOs, those smaller operators that are piggybacking and leasing off of the likes of AT&T and Verizon?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. It depends entirely on the contract that they have with the pipe provider. A lot of pipe providers at the moment have contracts which don't specify this. But what I suspect is when contract renewal comes up, they're going to find a few more clauses stuck in the boilerplate there, which will basically give either they share their rights to the marketing information or it all goes back to the main pipe supplier. So, I mean, in the case of sort of one ISP I spoke to, they have a clear contract which doesn't allow the pipe provider this kind of information. But, you know, as contracts get renewed, this is going to come up. It's going to be a sticking point. And if smaller companies insist on keeping their users' data private, then they may see cost increases in the cost of the actual pipe being supplied to them.
Is there any sort of thing that ISPs could be using this data for that they are already collecting and now will be able to collect more of on us for anything other than marketing?
Well, that's the big question. And under this law as it stands, then there are no restrictions on what they can use it for. Obviously, if they use it to break the law in some way, then they're going to be liable for that. But they can sell it on to third parties, which would include the government. I mean, the government already pays companies for data for use for surveillance purposes and for national security monitoring and that sort of thing. So it's really up to the ISPs, and it comes down to how much you trust them. And if you ask the average user of a certain internet provider beginning with C, maybe, then the trust levels are somewhere down near hell. But if you've got a good internet provider who you actually trust, then you know maybe you can decide that you're okay with that. The old argument, you've done nothing wrong, you've done nothing to fear, which is a bit of a fallacious one, but still a lot of people seem to feel that way. You know, it all comes down to how much you trust your ISP and how much you trust them to play fair with your data. But at the moment, there are no restrictions as to who it can be sold to. So, yes, it's very much, at the moment, we're going to have to see what the ISPs do with this. And if they're smart, they'll do it very softly and very gently and sort of develop this business slowly. If they're dumb, they'll go in with both feet and they're going to irritate an awful lot of users, particularly with things like search redirect.
Now, we've been talking a lot about ISPs because that's what this specific rollback of these rules applies to. But I do wonder, will this have ramifications for anyone other than ISPs? I'm particularly thinking about hardware device makers, Vizio, had a multi-million dollar settlement not that long ago with the FTC, as you mentioned, that does police some data collection in similar circumstances. In Vizio's case, they were fined for not asking for permission first. And this rollback gives the ISPs the ability to collect this without having to ask permission. So what about those TV makers, the, you know, smart refrigerator makers, the smart speaker makers, the smart light makers, like all of these other companies that are have these devices in our homes that are connecting to the internet?
Oh, indeed. Yeah. I mean, and Vizio's point is, as you correctly pointed out, is that they didn't put that in terms and conditions. And I think now what we're going to see is a rewriting of contracts so that this sort of data collection is built into the contract and companies are covered in that regard. But bear in mind also that at the end of the day, all that data, they can collect that data if they want, but the ISP is still going to get it as well. And I think it's going to be very unlikely that device manufacturers will be able to say to internet service providers, our data is our own, you don't use it, you don't collect it, you don't store it. So that's going to be a bun fight between the hardware manufacturers and the ISPs. I do think this is going to be, it has obviously enormous relevance in the case of Internet of Things devices in the home, because people get very, very twitchy about that, as we saw with the Google Voice pumping out ads thing. If you had, you know, a device like an Amazon Echo or a Google Home device, and the data that that was collecting and sending back to the servers also became the property of the ISPs, then I suggest those products would probably become a lot less attractive to an awful lot more people. After all, nobody wants someone listening in the house constantly and relaying that data to an advertising agency so you can get the advert for the latest drug or suppository or, you know, whatever it is they decide to flog that day.
Or whatever. Thank you, Ian. It is always a pleasure to talk to you. Ian is a reporter at The Register. Go to theregister.co.uk. He's got stories about the LastPass security issues, the Microsoft security issues, many other interesting things full of colorful language that I love to read. And he is at Ian Thompson on Twitter. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too.
All right, well, we got some feedback for you all here. Michael Goldstein writes, I have a simple response to your story on the establishment of an Office of American Innovation in the White House. And if you remember, this is something that will be headed up by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. My response is, show me the money. Over 27 years of federal civilian service, I witnessed and participated in the development of many innovative programs. Almost all ended up on the shelf for lack of implementation funds. So a really good point, Michael. You know, it's one thing to deliver a lot of talk and a lot of hype and come up with a great name like the Office of Innovation, but it's another thing to actually deliver and execute and implement changes. What do you think? I mean, it's definitely a show and prove situation here, right?
Yeah, I think the email was a little bit longer, and I had to cut out a little bit. But he also said, you know, how are you going to convince taxpayers to pay for it when, you know, we can't pay for Meals on Wheels? And, you know, it's absolutely true that, you know, we have to take a wait and see. But I do have a positive attitude toward this. We talked a little bit about it on MacBreak Weekly today, and Andy Notko from the Chicago Sun-Times had some points about the people behind some of the people that Trump is hiring do have the tech chops. There's, you know, they've been working on interesting, innovative ideas, like maybe, you know, a Peace Corps but for technology, like a tech core, those kinds of things. So I'm not going to knock it yet.
There might be plenty of time for that if they screwed up enough.
Yeah, exactly. So. Plenty of time to criticize
them. We'll have
them
our
later.
Chance.
Yes.
All right. Well, Amazon will deliver groceries to your car's trunk. Now, as long as you live in Seattle and you're a Prime member, here's how it works. You have to drive to one of two Amazon Fresh locations in Seattle. And then people, not robots yet, will load up your trunk with your grocery order. Amazon said in a video announcing the new service that orders can be filled in as little as 15 minutes, which sounds pretty great, right? Well, for those who can actually use the service called Amazon Fresh Pickup, you can get meats, produce, dairy, bread, and general household items as well. Now, there are more caveats, actually. Amazon says the service will eventually be free to Amazon Prime subscribers, but currently, it's in a beta test, and as such, it's only going to be available to Amazon employees. There is no word yet on when the beta will end, and all Seattle area Prime members will be able to take part. not to mention when it's going to spread to other parts of the country if it's a success. So, well, what do you think of this?
I do not enjoy the grocery shopping. It is not my favorite thing to do. So I like for someone else to do it for me. I mean, I've tried this with, you know, supermarkets where you go online and you order everything and then you, but my issue with that, it's like there's a pickup window.
Yes.
And I just can't plan ahead that much. And so, yeah, I can barely plan ahead to cook. So this sounds nice. I still really like the idea of the store where you walk in and you pick something up and then you walk out without paying. Like that.
Yeah.
That I want to happen. And I guess they're delaying that opening too, I heard.
Yeah, it sounds like they're delaying that as well, taking their time with testing these things out. I'm glad you mentioned that other grocery stores have similar services. I know Safeway had something similar not that long ago, and some even will deliver to your home, and there are apps for that as well. I am kind of curious, though, why Amazon is starting with their own customers here on what is a beta test. It really sounds like more of an alpha test if they're just kind of narrowing it that way.
Their own employees?
Yeah.
Sorry, their own employees.
Yeah, but they often do this. I know with their original like convenience marts in Seattle and their brick and mortar bookstores and their grocery stores, it seems to be a pretty common tactic. I mean, they've got a ton of employees in Seattle.
What if Amazon is really just creating an army of employees, you know, for like the robot apocalypse?
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, after everyone else is gone, it'll just be them and they're like superhuman. And so that's why they're testing all these services just with them. What do you think about that?
Well, I think as long as those robots keep buying stuff from their stores because they have like nowhere else to go, then I guess it's a self-sustaining business model. But it sounds terrifying and like the apocalypse. It sounds super convenient to have the stuff delivered to your trunk, to be able to cruise in and out, drive through, so to speak. And I've tried some of those apps where you get groceries delivered to your door, but I always feel incredibly lazy in doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta ask just how lazy this is in making us at the same time. I mean, grocery shopping does kind of sometimes stink, but sometimes it can be kind of nice to go in and actually pick stuff out for yourself.
Right, be among people.
Yeah, it's good to be around the people, right?
Yes, it is.
So don't take that away from us, Amazon.
Well, do you feel guilty when you order other stuff from Amazon and get it delivered to your door, like a book or a toothbrush or anything else you might?
Sometimes, but I'm in a neighborhood where there are a lot of like independent businesses. There's, you know, independent bookstores and independent film stores. There's actually this one called Le Video, which was right near my place, which I loved. Yeah, there's just a lot of stuff that you couldn't find on a streaming service. You know, classic films that are out of print and things like this, and they don't exist anymore, and that's a shame. So I love the convenience of a streaming service, but you know, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Burke chat.
Burke has some comments for us here.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that is important. Own your apathy.
Yes, thank you.
Because it is yours and no one else's.
Well, TNT records every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, and that is 7 p.m. Eastern. Perhaps it's 23 o'clock UTC. It is other times wherever you are. But you know what? You don't have to watch it on time. You can go to twit.tv/TNT and subscribe and download. Get it whenever you want. You can also email us, or you could leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can email us at tnt@twit.tv. There's so many ways to find us. Hit us up on Twitter, Tech News Today TV.
Find all the ways to subscribe, and there are so many, to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to see us in person, please do shoot us an email, and we'd love to really have you here as a live audience. That email is tickets@twit.tv. And if you want to tweet me, I'm on Twitter @NateOG.
And thank you to our technical director, Brian. Thanks to Burke for Burke chatting with us. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. Nate hosted Jason. Hosted security now. I get them so confused. I got really used to having you here.
Yeah.
But this is your last day for now on TNT. Jason hosted security now. He hosts All About Android right after this. He'll be back on TNT tomorrow. And Nate, thank you so much for joining us for these 6 days.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. It's been a blast. And things are going to come back to normal. So Jason's going to be back. And I'll be popping in from time to time when appropriate, or when someone goes on vacation or whatever goodness. But you'll also be able to see me a couple times a month on the new Screensavers on Saturdays. And I'm working on some of my own shows to eventually launch and host. So hopefully whenever we do come up with those, y'all will tune in then as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to you for watching.
Thanks.